Hi and welcome to the Unhindered Podcast. I'm taking over today. I'm Amity. I've been on the podcast before, and I am going to be interviewing Dad today about the seven essential practices for solving insecurity. And the purpose is just that we have a lot of new listeners and followers and people who don't know how to solve their insecurity, who don't even know that that's a thing and that it's possible. So we're just starting from absolute ground zero, how where to start, what to do. And just laying it all out really, really simple and just laying out the foundations. So, so Dad, as someone who doesn't have any idea that it's possible even, where do you begin?
Hello, Amity. Thank you for interviewing me. That's nice. Nice to talk to you again. Nice to have you home, actually.
To be home.
Been away for over a year, traveling the big wide world. All right, good. Thank you. So, where to start? Well, I like systems thinking. I like treating problems like an engineer. I like thinking. And so let's start it as a thinking problem, and just with the most accurate description of what insecurity is. So, good place to start, because I don't think people even know what it is. So, how can you solve something if you don't know what it is? So, I'll test you. What's your best definition of insecurity? What is it?
I guess it's a limiting belief that holds you back in some way, shape, or form from being the best version of yourself.
Well, it is that, but one of the tests that I'll invite you to consider and the listeners is just try these on. So when you hear a definition, go to thinking about the solution. So if the problem is it's a limiting belief that holds you back, well, yeah, sure, that makes sense. But the solution's not obvious, and the solution's big and overwhelming and hard. That's a big, broad problem. That's a very abstract problem. I don't think you can start with a belief. I think a belief is already, it's too far gone. It's too big. It's too scary. It's too abstract. It's just become a thing. So I think you have to look through that and be even more precise. So have another go. It's what do you mean when you say it's a limiting belief? And if you're thinking about it as a solvable problem, where do you go?
It is an internal subconscious agreement with the intention of protecting ourselves, but it inevitably holds us back. Is that any more solvable, less
It is
abstract?
solvable. Yeah, it is more, but it's still overwhelming. It's still, and for people
Mm-hmm.
thinking, okay, internal agreement, sure. What does that mean? And what would I do about that? So I think we can get more precise. And this is all practice one. So there's seven essential practices for overcoming insecurity. Practice one is to step into the light. And it just means examining, where are you starting from? What is here? Before you embark on a change process, you got to get clear of the lay of the land and where you're starting from. So people are starting from going, well, you're telling me there's an insecurity problem, and insecurity is the starting point. So what does that starting point mean exactly, so I can see it in all its precision? So I think the best way into that for someone starting out who've never considered this question is the simple idea: what are you afraid of? What are you most afraid of? If you had the give language around that. And it's a question that seems logical and simple, but is already it's already too scary for people to even touch. But I'm inviting you to touch that scary question and start there. What are you afraid of? So what do you think people generally say when I ask that question? What are you afraid of?
Afraid of people's judgment, afraid of failure, afraid of not accepted, not having enough time and money to do things, not being liked.
Great. They're all those things. And so you can categorize those into two areas: either some kind of fear of failure, like I'm going to try something, try my best at something, and it's not going to work out, or I'm going to put myself out there, I'm going to put the best of me out there, and I'm going to be rejected. So the same metric, if that's the problem, then does it feel overwhelming, or can you see a simple pathway? So it's still overwhelming, right? Because the fear of failure, that feels real, it feels solid. Fear of rejection, yeah, that is what I'm afraid of. But have a closer look and you realize it's not what you're afraid of. No one's afraid of failure or rejection. They're afraid of the personal implications of those two things, i.e., if I was to fail, what's so bad about that? Well, what happens is if you fail having tried your best, is that you are exposed. People see who you really are. Your best wasn't enough. So now you reveal your inadequacy. Same as rejection. No one's afraid of being rejected. They're afraid of if they tried their best and their best wasn't enough, what does it say about them? Now it reveals their inadequacy. So now we're getting closer. It turns out what we're afraid of is not what other people think about us, but what we think about us. We just don't want it confirmed by the world. That's insecurity. So we're getting warmer and warmer and warmer, but still not in the form of a solvable problem yet.
Because the fear of judgment and the fear of failure is not in any way, well, I suppose, unless you decide to hibernate for the rest of your life, but otherwise, it's not in any way something you can avoid. Like, no matter where you go, you will be judged and you will fail. So yeah, it is a very abstract
Yeah.
problem that can only be managed, not solved, when you look at it like that.
Exactly. So we're moving to the levers that we control, the things that we have direct ability to impact. And that is, okay, I can't control what others think about us, but I can control what I think about me. And that is actually what I'm afraid of, what I think about me. So when you look at that even more closely, you could describe insecurity as the fear of my own worst opinion of myself being confirmed by the world. And now we're getting really close to being solvable because if you look up opinion in the dictionary, it says the lowest form of knowing anything. So the weakest form of knowledge that exists. Like you and I were having conversations about differences of opinion about what I should put in my hair to stop my hair falling out. And my opinion was I had the right product. Your opinion was that I didn't. And who's to say? It's. When you look at what that opinion's based on, we both think we're right, but really, neither of us have done any kind of scientific research into the product. We just think we're right. So it's an opinion, it's not very strong. Now, you know the answer to this, I'm sure. You've heard me talk about this enough times. So insecurity is an opinion problem, but when was that opinion formed?
Sometime in the first 7 years of your life.
That is what all the research would say that we are sense-making creatures. We go into the world and we have to work out who we are, what's safe, what it means to be us. And that's a difficult thing to do as a kid. So, but by the time we're 7, we're pretty much made up our mind about who we are, who we're not, how we're going to be ourselves in the world. So, yeah, the worst opinion we form about ourselves is without doubt formed before we're 7. So now, we're not only dealing with the worst opinion we've got about ourselves, but the worst childish opinion we've got about ourselves. So, like, what kid has the ability to get that opinion right? So we can even go one step even more precise because, like, we're really in the solvable territory now, but we can make it even better. Any idea how we could make it even more precise? What's that?
Don't know.
Well, really be scientific, really be precise. So we've said it's an opinion problem, but opinion is a neutral word. Opinion doesn't carry a lot of energy with it, a lot of angst with it. But if you really examine the inception of all insecurity,
Activate.
it's a negative opinion. And the negative opinion is in the form of finger pointing. It's in the form of an accusation. So it's actually, you come into the world relaxed and at ease, and then in a surprising moment where being relaxed gets you hurt, gets you disappointed, gets you upset, you have to make sense of it, and you make sense of it personally against yourself. And in the process, you accuse yourself of being the reason it went bad. So, accusation is a very, very precise word because it says a specific person committed a specific crime in a specific instance. So, that's very, very precise, a moment in time. And so, yeah, we form an idea about what that accusation is. I'm sure it's There's one word attached to every accusation. It's the worst opinion we formed about ourselves in the form of an accusation. So we point the finger at ourselves and we say, oh, you are weak, you are weird, you are stupid, you are bad, you are worthless, you are unlovable, you are evil, whatever it is. But it takes the form of one precise word. And then because we think we're right about it, then we've got to make sure that no one else ever knows that's true. So that's insecurity. This accusation we formed as a kid, being seen by anyone else and being confirmed by anybody else. How does that, you've heard me talk about this before. Do you think I've missed anything? Does that work? How does it feel in terms of solvable, precise?
Yeah, no, that definitely sounds a lot more solvable, and less abstract. I find it so interesting looking at the structure of it as moving into your adult years with like childhood frameworks and childhood structures and structures that you came up with as a child. Because when I feel like when you put it like that, like no one wants to live their adulthood with any kind of like childhood mentality or childish or immature kind of framework, I guess. But I just, yeah, I find it very interesting when you look at it like that.
Exactly. And this is why so much about the solving of the problem is in naming it precisely, because fear unexamined grows. People don't even know what they're dealing with. And so it becomes a monster and it terrorizes them. And all of a sudden it's too big, too hard, too scary. When you look at it, you're like, wait, I'm being fooled by a kindergartner. Like it's like, wow, it's not a very smart way to live to have decided what was wrong with me when I was four. And then just confirm that bias for the rest of my adult life and never use my adult skills to go back and see if that kid got it right. Yeah, it's a strange thing to do. So I find soon as someone knows what they're dealing with, all of a sudden they're like, okay, not only must I solve this, but of course I can. Of course I could solve that. I'm ready. Yeah, let's go have a closer look.
Yeah, I also love the power of choice that it gives because which I'm sure you'll talk about soon, but that you made the accusation. It wasn't something that happened outside of the you and that you need someone else to fix. Like you're the one who made the accusation. You're the one who had that opinion. You're the one who made that story. So it puts it in so much more of a solvable light because if you made it, you can fix it.
Well, this is the fun of it. So yeah, as soon as you name it precisely, part of the precise naming of it has that, you did this to yourself, by the way, implicit in it. And then practice two, I just go, in case you missed the memo, if you're going to solve this, you solve this by realizing you are responsible for creating that accusation. Because the trap is people go, oh yeah, I could understand that I thought this was bad about me, a weak or weird, but you got to understand, my parents were like this, or I got bullied, or we didn't have any money, or things are really hard, or I got, used and abused or hurt or tricked. So yeah, no wonder I formed this idea. So yeah, the tendency is to think this is a problem created outside ourselves, but when you name it precisely, you see, no, you did this. And when you really follow the structure of how it gets solved, you must pass through practice two, 100% responsibility, which is not just taking responsibility, but realizing you've always been responsible. You're not the actor in the story, you're the storyteller. So yeah, I too, I love that because immediately if you created it, then you don't need anybody else to fix it for you. No one's coming to save you. You're the one who can change this. Did you ever read The Four Agreements?
Yes, I did.
Did that have an impact on you?
I read a long time ago, so I'd say yes, but not a big enough impact for me to be currently living consciously by the four agreements.
Well, the reason I bring it up is I just haven't heard anyone describe this, the logic for practice two, better than Don Miguel Ruiz. So in that Four Agreements, and it's just setting up the problem, saying, look, I know it makes sense to think that you were impacted by the words spoken to or about you, And it makes sense. That's what changed your life. Because people can often point to these words. You've got to understand, when I was in kindergarten, my teacher said I was stupid. What am I supposed to do? Or when I was playing soccer when I was a kid, my dad said, I'm an idiot. Or, that did actually happen, and those words changed my life. It seems really clear that that's what went down. But Don McGuill says, look, you got to know it's not the words spoken to you or about you that change your life, just the ones you agree with. So therefore, no one has the power to bless you or curse you without your position, your permission. So it just highlights where the action's really taking place, breaks through the misdirection, and just says, yeah, you cursed you. So not to point the finger and say, you're an idiot for cursing you, just to highlight what went down. So if you cursed you, then it's logical that you're the only one who can uncurse you. I think it's a must read book, but yeah, that there's lots of great things in it, but that to me is the greatest contribution in that book. Just the idea of not only did you accuse, you then agreed. So what do you understand happens when you agree with words?
Well, it becomes sort of your biased filter. So once you agree with something, that's kind of all you see, and your whole perception of reality becomes biased to what you agree with. So if you did agree with someone calling you ugly, then you find 100 other opportunities to, confirm that that is true.
Yeah, well, that's what happens, but there's a missing piece in there if you really examine the action. When someone might say you're an idiot, and you go, do you know what? Yeah, I think they're right. As soon as you agree, as soon as you double down, as soon as you confirm two point, like join two points of data, their data, your data, and go, yep, I agree, lock it in, thank you get the chemistry of certainty.
And then you put all your energy into counteracting that.
Well, before that, though, the chemistry of certainty. Have you heard me describe the chemistry of certainty?
I'm not sure.
Well, try this on. So think about when you've gone out into the world, had an experience, made sense of it, and then gone, I'm right. I am right. Like your body gives you chemicals when your brain does that. It locks it in, it solidifies it. It's like I feel it, like it's not just an abstract concept now. Your whole body agrees with you. You feel certain. Certainty is a feeling, it's an emotion, it's solid. And so this resonance is going through your whole body, and it is, you are locking something in. You are now not running hypotheses, you're not experimenting, you're not like, oh, I'm unsure. No, you're sure. You are sure. You are now acting from a position of certainty. So if you are certain that you're weak, weird, bad, wrong, well then yeah, you must put all your best energy into making sure no one else ever knows it's true. But it's just really useful to notice that when you double down on something, when you agree positively or negatively, like your body reinforces that for you, and then it's very hard to change once you've got that certainty. You're like, yeah, I'm right. I'm blinkered to everything else now because I'm right about this. Have
Did
you
you say lock it in, Eddie?
lock it in, Eddie? Yeah, is that a
Who is
reference for
this?
your generation?
Yeah, who is this Eddie that you're reading now?
You're so lucky that you don't know Eddie Maguire. He was like the main cat on TV. Well, in my formative years, he was a football. Well, he's still a football commentator, I believe. He was the president of the Collingwood Football Club. But his real moment in the sun was, who wants to be a millionaire?
Ah, I see.
And so he'd say, do you want, which one is it, A or B? And they'd say, B. Are you sure? Lock it in, Eddie. So
I hear that a lot, and I've never known who Eddie is.
there you go. Yeah, so that's number two. Number one, step into the light and specifically name your fear. Of what are you actually afraid of? Yoda says, name must your fear be before banish it you can. So name it as absolutely precisely as you can. A childhood accusation, and don't just leave it there. What accusation? What did you say exactly, precisely? And if you're not sure, we'll work your way backwards. Like, you want to know what you said about yourself? Have a look at how you behave on the repeat now. What must you believe about yourself in order to behave that way? And then practice two. Well, if it, in case it was unclear, you not only accused, but you then agreed. So you really built this insecurity problem yourself. You designed a whole world around your own sense making, your map of the world. Clear? You're interviewing me, remember, you asked the questions.
Sorry. Great. So, yes, essential practice number one, step into the light. Name what your fear really is. So, can you tell us about essential practice number two?
No, we just did that. We just did. I must have done it very well.
True,
No.
yeah, I heard you mention it, but
Number two is responsibility. Not only, like, it's 100% responsibility. Not only take responsibility, but realize you're the center. You're the one pulling all the levers. You're the storyteller. It's all you.
yes, beautiful,
No one's
okay,
coming to save you.
beautiful. And number three, please, Eddie.
Stack the pain. Little abstract, what does that mean to you?
Kind of 50% of the leverage and the motivation to get to where you want and to get through the other side of solving your insecurity is the pain and moving away from that pain. And so stacking it is, because a lot of people kind of like out of, I guess, gratitude and humbleness, they're like, oh, I hate it, but it's actually not that bad. It's okay. Like a lot of people have it a lot worse when they really just downplay it, optimistic about it. But just to actually be really realistic and name everything that's giving you pain, be honest about it, weigh it honestly, and yeah, stack it up, I guess, to give you that motivation to get through.
Yeah, well done. That's really clear. And it's just to understand that every cell in our body is hardwired to move away from pain. That's an instinctive response. You don't even have to be conscious about that. So if you have a link to pain, if you link public speaking to pain, you will avoid it. If you link heights to pain, you will avoid that. If you link conflict to pain, you'll avoid that. So most people unconsciously have linked greater pain to change and have ignored the pain of staying the same. So if you consciously give your unconscious a hand by going, hang on, let me tell the truth about the cost of being here, you can flip that. You can go, hang on, there's now more pain in being here, i.e. being insecure, than whatever is required to deal with the insecurity. Because there'll be some pain in going back into your past, in hashing old memories, in examining pockets of fear and embarrassment and shame. There'll be pain there, but you'll always avoid that if you don't tell the truth about the fact that insecurity is actually killing you. It's ruining your relationships. It's hindering your work. It's making you obsess about what others think about you. Like, it's not, yeah, it may be producing some extra energy and motivation to prove to people how awesome you are. But if you look at the whole package, it is killing you. It's a slow descent into madness. So as soon as you tell the truth about that, then you create automatic motivation to take the next step to go, yeah, I can't stay here, my house is on fire. So, all right, whatever's involved, I'm ready to go back and examine this accusation and agreement I've made about myself.
And so what is the second half of the motivation in number four?
Well, yeah, Tony Robbins describes this best. He calls it a pressure cooker system. So if you just have a pain avoidance strategy, then massive pain creates massive motivation. Massive motivation leads to massive action. Massive action leads to massive change. Massive change dials down the pain, which dials down the motivation, the action, the change. So it's typically how people do it. They just do enough to get out of pain. So to really solve this, and this was my work. I didn't invent these seven. I just deconstructed it. I went and found people who had solved the problem. They just hadn't worked out how. And I found they didn't just rely on pain. Pain will let you down. Desire is the other half. What, not just what don't you want, what do you want instead? What's the dream for your life? What are you really looking for? What do you want to have happen? What are you moving towards? Not what are you moving away from? How was this one for you when you went through the process? Did you notice the the motivation you got from pain ran out, and then you really required the motivation from desire.
Yeah, definitely. And it got to a point where, there was a lot of pain. And then moving through that to a point where my problems were in a way kind of working for me. Like I was actively working through my insecurities. So then I got like a free ticket from everyone because they're like, ah, oh, it's all right. We know you're still really annoying, but you're working through it. It's okay. And then also, getting to get coaching and get attention. So daddy issues. And yeah, it got to a point where it was really working for me. But then I still obviously wasn't getting what I wanted. So the pain was less, but not getting what I wanted. And yeah, really just had to articulate that and get back into that state of moving back towards what I want and sacking the pain of how it really is instead of kind of just settling for the ways that it was working for me.
Excellent. What do you think the hardest part about practice four is? Develop a compelling vision for your life.
Well, the permission to actually want something, and you said that you can't be free to actually want what you want if you're insecure. So it's quite a challenge to convince yourself that you can actually want what you want when you haven't actually quite gotten to that point of solving that insecurity. So you've still got all that head noise about, oh, that's a stupid idea, I can't have that, or that's unrealistic, or I don't deserve that. So there's a lot to get through to actually find the courage and the freedom to say what you want and actually want it. I think that's quite a hard thing. And what you should want, and what others tell you to want, and what's normal to want versus what you genuinely really, really want.
Yeah, I couldn't have said that better myself. That's inevitable. People get stuck. It's quite the conundrum, the paradox. To solve this, you need to focus on what you want, but you can't focus on what you want because you're insecure that you don't deserve it, or it's too hard for you, you're not capable. So, really weird. What's the solution? What do you do?
Well, you stack the pain, so that adds as motivation to actually do the work to figure out what you want. But I mean, silly ideas only is pretty effective in working through figuring out what you actually want.
It's what I use, silly ideas only, because if you can name that paradox it and then settle down, then because often people get to that paradox and they think, oh, you don't understand, this is really hard for me. The number of times that people say, oh, Jamin, yeah, like what do you want? Like that's actually a really hard question for me. Oh, it's a hard question for you, is it? No, it's the hardest question for everyone, and it's an impossible question when you get to this part. So if you can see that's predictable and you're not broken and you haven't somehow dropped out of the system, then you can relax a little. And then the way in is a silly ideas only game. So you go, all right, just play, just have fun with this. Go, imagine you had a magic wand, and you could have anything. If what anything would you want? So and play a game. So I'd have a nice pen, blank page, silly ideas only. Jamin, if you could have anything, what anything would you want? Silly ideas only. So two rules of the game: no accountability, no responsibility. For anything you write down, no one's going to see it, and you don't have to do anything. So you can't get it wrong, and it's called silly ideas only. So the tendency is you'll write a goal down, you go, oh, that's stupid. Yeah, that's the name of the game. So swing away. The sillier the better. Silly, 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 silly. And as soon as you create that space of play, the fun of that game is, without exception, you won't be able to tell the difference between your most honest ideas and your silliest ideas the first time they come out. So you will create this glitch in the matrix where you hear the truth in amidst the whole bunch of silliness. And if you play this game on repeat for a little while, the patterns of truth will keep coming out and you'll hear your own heart. Your heart will find a space where it can talk to you. And then you really build the tension because then you go, oh my goodness, I do want that. I actually do want that. Wow. And if I don't deal with this insecurity, I'll never get it. So carry on, keep going. Now I've got something pulling me forward rather than just, pushing me out of pain. Is that how it worked for you?
Every time I do the silly ideas only game, the first thing I write down is I want to fly. So maybe my real purpose in life is to create jetpacks or something.
Well, it's a great start because you go, well, that's silly. You can't have that. Great. Then you're taking all the pressure off. Now you're inside the game. So, and if you didn't judge yourself for that, then you're not going to judge yourself for anything. So swing away. What else? What else? What else? What else? And I play that game for years, like 2 or 3 times a week for maybe 15 years. I think it's probably one of the most effective, important things I've ever done. And all my best ideas have started out as silly ideas. So. Yeah, the hero's got to have a quest as well. So if you're not trying to do something meaningful, if you're not following your heart, if you're not ambitious to improve, what's the point of risking your life, of facing your fear? It's all too hard. So that's an essential structure for anyone who actually solves this.
So once you have stepped into the light, you've taken responsibility, you've sacked the pain, you've figured out what you really want, then what do you have to do?
Well, get help from someone who doesn't care about you is practice five. We've had lots of conversations about this. We've experimented with this. I'm coaching you now, and not in this conversation, but we're back in some other coaching conversations, which is so wild. And I discouraged you greatly from going ahead, just like I discouraged your mother from the same. I was not looking forward to coaching you. I didn't think I should. And you were like, yeah, of course, let's do it. And the only possible way to move forward was to go, well, watch what happens if we create a clean conversation where, yes, I'm your dad, but we'll set up a frame that's so clean that I won't be your dad. I'll be someone whose only intention is to serve you, to help you get more of what you want. And therefore, you can't implicate yourself. You can tell the truth without fear of saying the wrong thing. There is no wrong thing. I don't care. I'm not invested. So, why do you think that one makes the list of essential practices?
To get help from someone who doesn't care. Well, that's really the essence of your coaching, I think. I think it's the most essential part, honestly, because it's so rare and you don't get it anywhere else. And it just I've been thinking about it a lot recently, to be honest, but the
Did you say ever a
removal
movement?
of judgment and the removal of care though, because care is judgment. If someone cares about you, they have expectations for you and they want the best for you and they want you to keep pushing through and to get out the other side. And if you don't, then they judge you. And it's just an inevitable, there's inevitable judgment in anything that you care about or anyone who cares about your journey. And there's also that personal investment where them helping you makes them feel good. And so it becomes a two-part problem where, they want the best for you, but they also want to feel like a really good person. So it just becomes so messy and weirded out, and no one's pragmatic, no one's clean, everyone's trying to get what they want. It also creates a really nice spot for the victim card to become well used. And so just removing the judgment means, sorry, removing the care remains removing the judgment, which means that, and I love what you say, where you're then free to give the real answer, not the right answer. I think that's so profound in that, like, that's what I was actually talking about that with you this morning. I kept giving the right answer, but as soon as I stop judging myself, it becomes the real answer. And I think that that's really it's really unique for this space. And I hear a lot of people talk about they go to therapy and psychologists and everything, and they're so aware of their problems that the therapy and the psychologists stop working, and then they become a special category of people that just can't be fixed and can't be worked on because they already know everything. They already know how they all work. They already know what they're doing. They're aware of their problems, but then they can't change it. And I think that becomes really prominent in the space of psychologists and counselors, where they pretend, well, they, I don't know, maybe they do care about you, but they say that they care about you, but then there's just no objectivity, there's no pragmatism, it's just caring, oh, you can try this and this is what's really going on. Anyway, it just gets messy. I think it's honestly one of my favorite frameworks is just the judgment-free space, which is getting help from someone who doesn't care about you.
It's the hardest thing to do, but I agree. I think it's the only thing that makes this work, because to deal with insecurity, it's the deepest, hardest, scariest problem. It's the existential angst. It drives everything. So most people will never overcome it. So in all you need to solve it is objectivity. Like we've laid it out, we're just dealing with the opinion accusation of a scared child. But because it's gathered so much evidence and created so much momentum, it feels much bigger than that. So all you need is to see it clearly, and that's the challenge. You'll bring your own judgment, your own fear, your own shame, your own embarrassment, your own map of the world. You won't be able to see yourself clearly. So you can't really have awareness, and then muddy that with someone else's judgment, their expectations, their wanting, and you just can't see. So I think what happens when create a clean space is it becomes possible to see what's going on and treat it like an engineering problem, just be scientific. So people always test me on that. Like they'll fear that I'll be cold and clinical and that'll feel robotic. But it's not been my experience. People kind of get that I'm all in, and I just wouldn't dare cross the line by wanting for them, because then I'd get in the way. So I find the moment they believe me that I'm 100% there to serve them, and my serving them is letting them, treating them as a responsible adult. You created this mess. You're the only one who can save this. Save you. No one's coming to save you. So that's a lovely thing when someone empowers you that way. Then it becomes safe to tell the truth. And if you can tell the truth and I can tell the truth, well, then this problem gets solved very quickly. If we can't tell the truth, we don't even know what we're dealing with. We're fighting shadows, getting stuck in loops and blind spots.
And what you said about you can't do awareness and judgment at the same time. That's kind of where I was going with the whole people that are really hyper, well, they say that they're hyper aware of their problems. It's not genuine awareness, it's judgment, but because they're getting help from people that are invested and they care, there's judgment from both parties. So no one can pull anyone out of that judgment to see it pragmatically to then actually solve it rather than just look at it and keep going, is where I was going with that.
Yeah, I wonder where you're going with it. You got close to landing the plane, but you came back, and that was a good landing then. Yeah, that
Yeah,
is it. You
thank
can't
you.
do judgment and awareness at the same time. You can't actually see with, it's not safe to see, in case what you see implicates you, in case it shouldn't be there. It's wrong, it's bad. But if there's no wrong or bad, then you can see anything. And as soon as you can see anything, you very quickly see the real parts of this structure.
Yeah. And so then what? What's number six?
Well, I like it, the metaphor of the hero's journey, because the hero always needs a guide. There's always a wisdom character, a Gandalf, a Yoda, a Dumbledore, Mr. Miyagi. And it's always, it's a weak character on a journey to fulfill their destiny. So you're introduced to someone who's scared, afraid, small, insignificant, a Frodo, a Daniel, a Harry, a Luke. They meet the wisdom character. And when you see the wisdom character introduced into the story, you think they're going to save the day, but they never save the day. They just bring the hero to the point where they've got to do the thing, and then they bugger off. They're always out of the picture. So very useful to go, no one's coming to save you. Like actually, no one's coming to save you. So the next thing is, all right, you got to save you. You've actually got to go face this fear. You got to face the monster. You got to go back to the beginning. No one wants to go back to the beginning. No one actually wants to get their hands dirty and face their fear. And Joseph Campbell, who was the one who coined the term the hero's journey, he says, the cave you fear also holds the treasure you seek. So, and in the hero's journey, the hero faces this huge dilemma, because they've embarked on a journey. They've said yes to a call to adventure. They've followed their heart. They've overcome a bunch of obstacles, and now here's the big one. They've got to do the thing that they can't do. Their whole life they've had this story that they're not good enough, strong enough, smart enough, and now they've got to do the thing that directly confronts that assumption. And so it looks like it's impossible. Looks like they'll die if they do, and yet they can't go home because they're already so far into the process. So they either die or they come out the other side transformed. That's the only two options. And without being dramatic, that's exactly how it has to be. You eventually gonna go fa you're gonna have to go face that accusation. You're gonna go back to the courtroom. You're gonna have to put yourself back on trial. You're gonna have to review the evidence. You're gonna have to see, did you get it right or did you get it wrong? And that has a definitive answer. Like, that's not personal development culture, which is slowly, slowly making progress over time. I'm getting there. I'm gradually learning to love myself. What do you mean? Like, all insecurity sits on is a precise moment in time where you accuse yourself of a specific crime. And eventually you're going to have to go, did you get it right or wrong? And if you got it right, you die. And if you got it wrong, you go free. So, and only you can tell because you were the one who made the accusation in the first place.
Yeah. I love that articulating it as the hero's journey really just specifies that it is hard, and that it's not a gentle, soft, enlightening kind of, learning to love yourself. Like, it is really genuinely hard. It's the hardest thing that I've ever done. But just putting it out there, like, it's hard. It makes it a lot. I mean, just what we were talking about this morning is that when you know it's hard, then you can stay in the game. It's not that you've been disqualified from the game because it's hard. It's a hard game, and we only play hard games.
We only play hard games. Yeah, it's exactly. And being able to connect to that metaphor, every book you've loved, every movie you've watched that's followed the hero's journey, if it was a foregone conclusion, if the hero was given it magically, if the hero didn't have to work for it, there's no way you're reading that book or that movie, watching that movie. It's ridiculous. So the tension has to be, this looks impossible. I don't think Frodo's going to make it. I don't think he's going to make it. I don't think Daniel's going to win the karate. I don't think Harry's going to. I've never actually watched Harry Potter, but I understand that it's the same story. Whatever Harry does, it's got to look impossible, and it's got to actually be impossible because the impossibility is just the story that you told about yourself. So it's not actually impossible. It's just become impossible in your mind because of what you accuse yourself of. So Marcus Aurelius says the obstacle is the way. So the thing that stands in the path that seems to impede the path, no, that is the path. You've got to do the thing you can't. And in doing the thing you can't, you demonstrate to yourself that you always could and therefore find who you really are. There's no other way. You can't stay logical and clinical and like a student and just understand knowledge. Eventually, the implication of the knowledge is you've got to go into the cave and face the thing you're most afraid of.
I love the analogy of the writers of Superman, that they had to add kryptonite because he was so strong that he never lost, and no one would read it anymore.
Me too, but you might be experiencing the curse of knowledge too. You've dabbled in this space a long time, and to gamify it is the next thing. But before you gamify it and understand that the simplest structure, if we're talking 101, let's talk about Superman next conversation.
Okay. Yeah, so to go back, gamification is definitely, I think it's like the favorite concept that you teach. I use it like with my horses a lot as well. I use it with everything really. I think it is gold. So please talk about gamification.
No, next time. I'm only going to talk about next time.
What? I thought isn't that number seven?
No. Number seven's rewrite the story.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I
So,
agree. Gamification's everything. I think it's just a cheat code into this whole process.
yeah. Why is it not part of the seven essential then?
Well, because it is, but it's a little more abstract. So this is a thinking exercise first. It's logical, it's rational, it's be an adult. It's don't try and escape your humanity into some hypnosis exercise or NLP or psychedelic experience or spiritual experience to escape the problem. It's face the problem head on. That's how this starts. Turn all the lights on and use your brain. and think about this like a rational, intelligent adult. That's where you start. That's 101. And yeah, then we can become abstract and gamify and invite spirituality and all the tricks in there. But let's start at the very narrow gate. It's the thinking exercise. So
Yeah.
yeah, so practice seven is rewrite the story. So having
Having
faced your fear, that is to deconstruct the old story all the way back to the start. That is to go into the courtroom, bring new evidence, review the old evidence, and say, huh, that accusation that I am weak, weird, stupid, bad, wrong, inadequate, that there is no evidence. There's never been any evidence. It's a misunderstanding. It's a mistake. I got it wrong. I am not who I said I was. All this energy to protect myself from who I said I was, it dissolves because the foundation is not there. I am not that person. That's not true. And then you get the verdict. Yeah, you are not guilty. You are free to go. So you come out of the cave free, but you're going to need a new foundation to build your life on because that's been the foundation you build everything on from there. So practice seven is okay, you wrote the first story, now write the second one. And keep looking. You just discovered you weren't weak, bad, wrong, stupid, terrible, worthless. So then who are you? What is the truth now that you're free to see? And I like you said this on the last interview I did with you. You said, I underestimated what was involved in practice seven. I thought, yeah, that's a cinch. You're just a good, done. But there's a bit of stuff to do. So do you remember saying that? Do you remember what specifically was the work involved in practice seven?
Pressure test. That was crazy because I kept thinking that I must have missed something or that I had to go back and fix something. But just the pressure of agreeing with the new story, it's intense. It was a real challenge, but yeah.
Well, before you can have the new story pressure tested, you have to write the new story. So just one step back, if we're really 101. So the specifics around what do you understand about replacing accusation with new story? What was that like for you?
I mean, you can't replace without reconciling. So reconciling was more of a challenge than just replacing it, I found. I didn't find it too much of a challenge to rewrite the story. It was just agreeing with that story and believing that story and setting that story in place that I found really challenging.
Okay, but what did you build your new story on? What foundational truth did you start with?
That my old story was false, that I didn't need to believe out of that story anymore.
That's be the hero. When you come out of the cave, knowing the old story is not false, then what do you build the new story on?
I don't know. What do you build it
Well,
on?
this is not because you haven't done it, but because it's become unconscious now and you can't see. And this is the value of this conversation, to go make all the steps really explicit. So you had a look, you went back and had a look, and you went, huh, look at that, I'm actually wonderful. Like you came out of the experience of looking at yourself with a word, with a new word. Yeah, huh. Wow. What was your old accusation? Oh, that you were stupid and annoying. And you went, no, that's not true. I'm actually wonderful. I've always been wonderful and I see that. So,
It's built on new evidence that you see through that new bias. Well, not new evidence, but looking back at the old data with the new bias and then changing that evidence.
no, that's not it.
No.
No, because you've just removed the old lens. Now you're actually free to see what's always been there, unbiased. And you went, like, otherwise, you're trying to be wonderful. I've got to try and be the opposite of what I was. That's not how it gets solved. You clear the slate and then you go back and discover. So for me, I always thought I was average. That was the indictment. That might not sound very dramatic for other people, but it was very dramatic for me. I was a very ambitious kid and I reached the conclusion very early on in my life that ambition was such a curse because I, at my best, was average. I wasn't a bad kid, but I was vanilla, ordinary, plain, middle of the road. I was just a kid. There was nothing special about me. So I carried that for years and tried to prove it wasn't right and protect my other people from seeing that and all the energy into that until I did this, went back and had a look and realized, huh, I've never been average a day in my life. I am delightful. And the mantra I used, I don't know if you use this one or your version of this. I got this from Tony Robbins. Hey, Jamin, I deeply love and accept you. And I did it in the nude, in the mirror, and emphasized a different word each time around and around. Hey, Jamin, I, hey, Jamin, I deeply again and again and again. And then it naturally, did you use that mantra?
Did not.
And then I. Then it naturally morphed into, hey, Jamin, I deeply love and accept you. And I see you. And I like you. And you are delightful. And it was such a shock to me because I'd known that all the way back at the beginning, but then I'd forgotten that. So that was me coming home to see what had always been there. I am delightful. Can you see it? Yeah, I can see it. Wow, it's actually true. So then I emerge with a new foundation, a new word to build my future on. And then you can pressure test it. Then you gotta hold that in the fiery furnace of the real world. But yeah, you're not creating a new word, you're not wishing and you're not replacing it with the opposite. You're just, can you see you, the real you, the you you've always been? Can you come home? You know, a man searches the whole world for hidden treasure, only to realize he had it with him from the beginning. So does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely.
That's what you did.
Yes.
So the story state strategy model is part of the pressure test. Do you remember how that one works?
A lot of people run. What do they run? Strategy, state, story. And so the point of the story state strategy is, you change your story, which then inevitably puts you into a great state, and then from there you can run an efficient strategy.
Well, not really, but that's not a bad attempt. I'll tell you how it
Go.
works. Most people live strategy, state, story, get up in the morning, and their attention goes to what do I need to do? What's required of me? What action? What energy? What output? What are my responsibilities? Based on whatever state they find themselves in. So if they're feeling energized, maybe their strategy's good. If they're feeling terrible, then good luck acting out their strategy. So they start with strategy based on whatever state they find themselves in with no awareness of the story. Because it doesn't even feel like a story, it feels like their life. So it's a very limited place to live from. But practice seven, rewrite the story, is to go the opposite, live story, state, strategy. So that is to start the day mindful of being the storyteller. Hang on, who am I? Not what do I need to do, who am I again? And am I sure? So every time I've updated my story, I spend the first 2 or 3 weeks every morning out on the water tank, do laps around the water tank. And the question is, hang on, who are you again, Jamin? And I know my new word is I'm delightful, but it just sounds like a word until I agree with it. So my job is to walk around that tank until I've agreed, till I've seen it again, and I know it's true. I don't know if I've ever articulated, do you know how you can tell that you've agreed with it?
Because you can wholeheartedly feel it.
Chemistry of certainty again. You feel it, you're like, ah, yes. That's true. So whether that took me 10 seconds or 10 minutes, and it was always weird because I was aware that someone might be looking at me through the pine trees or thinking, what's this weirdo doing? But I just knew that's my job to start the day story. Who am I? Are you sure? Yeah, I'm delightful. Good. Don't get off that tank until you know who you are. Because when you know who you are, then you know what to do. If you don't know who you are, how are you supposed to know what to do? Then practice state management. So then go. Practice life-giving rituals that get you in a good state. So a good state doesn't automatically flow from a good story. It helps, but then go cook eggs, listen to music, get dressed, cologne, coffee, all the things that give me energy, and then go and do the obvious action. So, does that make sense?
Yes.
And to expect a pressure test in that, to expect it to be hard, to expect the real world to come at you and go, you're delightful, are you? What about when this happens? What about when you run out of money? What about when this person doesn't like you? What about when this person's upset with you? What about when you embarrass yourself? Are you still delightful then? So to handle all the difficulties, still going, no, I know who I am, and it's solid, it's locked in, I have agreed with this. Then you're cool, then you exit the pressure test. I'm not on the water tank every morning just for 2 or 3 weeks. That's lock it in, Eddie. Good to go. And then I experience a period of being unhindered, free, nothing to prove, nothing to defend, out in the real world, swinging away.
And I think that in the periods that you were just talking about, the contrast of them, so it's not constant flatline unhinderedness, it's unhindered, and then you come kind of back down into that space, but that space of maybe uncertainty or limiting beliefs or struggle is the gift, because then you unlock the next level of unhinderedness. But I think that that's something that I think about a lot, because we kind of want flatline good, but that's just not how anything works. But the point is that the gift is in coming down again, because then you get the next up, and you get the next level, and the next gift, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah, and the downs are never as low as they were the time before, and the highs are higher the next time. So yeah, you
Yeah.
are on a growth trajectory. But you're right. Yeah, the solving of one problem is the creation of the next. So you come into the world unhindered. Your world gets bigger, more complex. You say yes to things you previously said no to. You invite more uncertainty, more complexity, and then you get stuck again because now you come face to face with the next thing about you that you've misunderstood. And the same seven practices that got you free the first time get you free the next time, and you get quicker and you have more fun with it each time.
Wonderful. And that's all seven. So we have number one, step into the light, name what your fear really is. Number two, take 100% responsibility. Number three, stack the pain. Number four, what do you really want? Number five, the hero's journey.
Get help
No.
from somebody who doesn't care.
Yes. Get help from someone who doesn't care. Number six, the hero's journey.
Be the hero. So it's
Be a
all the
hero.
hero's journey, but specifically, you got to go do the hero work.
And then number seven is story state strategy.
Rewrite the
Rewrite
story.
story. Rewrite story. Wonderful.
Yeah. And they're all laid out in the book, The Seven Essential Practices for Overcoming Insecurity. Yeah. When people are ready to explore it, then yeah, we're both here to help. We're both here to be a dispassionate observer and take you through a process where you're the hero. So,
Wonderful. Well, thank you for coming onto my podcast, Jamin. You've been a lovely guest. It's been great to have you. Have a lovely day.
Excellent. Thank you, Amity. That was very enjoyable.
You. Bye.